net zero targets that are driving up the cost of gas and electricity, getting them off as well would have a huge positive impact too. But absolutely, there is going to also be a huge dose of scepticism, because the 2019 Conservative government promised change and levelling up, but that didn't happen. If your whole model is based on having foreign students simply to prop up your cash pool, and which is many of those lower grade universities in terms of quality that they provide, once you go bankrupt, that's tough. That's just the way it is.
Welcome to the Reform Party podcast. I'm Wendy Whittaker-Large, co-host of the podcast, and I'm delighted today to have a very special guest in the studio with us. So my guest today is Jonathan Gullis.
Thank you for having me. It's really, truly an honour, and I look forward to taking a grilling that I know many of your viewers and listeners will be keen for.
Well, I want to start really with the decision that brought you here. You obviously chose initially to be part of the Conservative Party. That was your choice, and you stood for the Conservatives in 2019. You won a significant majority at that election as well, and that seat had been Labour for decades. So when was it that you realised that the Conservative Party was no longer the party for you?
So look, leaving is never an easy decision. I joined the Conservative Party at 18 years old. My entire adult life, 18 years, has been as a Conservative Party member. And like anything, you're told there's a broad church and you sometimes will have to win and sometimes you have to lose your battles internally. But, you know, I went into that 2024 general election feeling that it was only right that the voters of Stoke-on-Trent North got to sack me as the Member of Parliament as much as they had the right to elect me back in 2019. And rightly they got to sack me, because a lot of promises were made, a lot of promises were broken, and essentially 14 years, there was a deep level of resentment and disappointment in what the Conservative Party said and promised, and actually what it then did in practice. And I shared those frustrations internally and had many of the internal arguments. I then stayed on because I wanted to give the Conservative Party the chance to see, had it learnt the lessons, had it understood the message the electorate was sending it. And essentially after sort of 12 months, I realised this just wasn't going to happen. And that inevitably within the Conservative Party, what we're seeing now with Andy Street, Ruth Davidson, David Gawke, David Lidington, and many of the so-called One Nationers, the WETs as I probably refer to them as, no matter who's leading the Conservative Party, despite all the recent rhetoric and stuff that I'm sure many of us don't mind hearing from the Conservative Party, the problem is that large cohort that Andy Street and Ruth Davidson are representing are in positions of leadership up and down the country within the Conservative Party rank and file, from the voluntary party to CCHQ to its own members of parliament. And so my view was that we're only hearing what is sounding vaguely like conservatism from the Conservative Party because Reform UK exists. And if Reform UK didn't exist, I don't believe for a second the Conservative Party would be trying to make out that it's now the party of the centre-right like it wants to. And so therefore, I can't, with all good faith, go and look a voter in the face and say, if the voters, if you vote Conservative, then please believe us. Because I didn't believe them and I didn't trust them any further. And what I did and looked at with Reform UK has got spent time getting to know Nigel Farage since February 2024. Same with Richard Tice. Obviously, know Lee Anderson, former colleague of mine, obviously before his defection, and seeing very many good people, particularly Danny Kruger, who myself, Miriam Cates, and he set up the New Conservatives, which I think shares a lot of Reform's vision and values for future Britain, made me realise that, you know, the centre-right is realigning in British politics and the Conservative Party just don't get it and never will get it. And that if I want to play a role as a member, if I want to be politically active, that the only way to defeat the socialist government was to become a member of Reform UK, because they share my worldview of what we need to do by putting the British people first, by putting the, you know, reindustrialising our nation, actually getting control of our borders, having proper law and order once and again on our streets, and actually trying to come up with an economy that does spread wealth and opportunity across the nation, not just gimmicks like levelling up, which ended up being pots of money that we were grateful for when I was a Member of Parliament, but weren't fundamentally going to change the issues of poverty, low wage, low skills, etc. So I genuinely feel reinvigorated and at home, and I get there will be scepticism, from well, the four members.
I think that's true, because if you look at your time in the Conservative Party, by 2019, things were already going downhill. But 2015, Theresa May passed the Climate Change Act. Well, that came to Parliament, it got passed. So anybody standing in 2019, I think, might have seen the winds of change already and understood the direction of travel. I'm surprised that you didn't.
So there were obviously things I disagree with. And to be quite frank, I'm, you know, from a teaching background. So there were also elements of policy that I simply just didn't understand. And it was actually being a member of parliament that gave me time. And also living and representing an area like Stoke-on-Trent, very different from the rural shires of Warwickshire that I grew up in. So to actually engage with ceramic manufacturers, to understand the impact that the Climate Change Act, that net zero was having on those industries, was an eye-opener for me, and a realisation that this is just madness personified, and that we're going to make our country poorer and colder and see manufacturing completely wiped out, which means in places like Stoke, good jobs that have been around for generations, fathers and sons following each other into those factories, would have all just disappeared, and therefore a city would have lost its identity as it's known, the pottery. So I absolutely accept that maybe I should have been more open-eyed to certain things. Maybe I should have been willing to start this journey sooner. But at the same time, there was no real viable alternative I felt at that time other than the Conservative Party on the centre-right of British politics. And also naively thought that, oh, well, I and others that I had huge respect and admiration for, particularly in that European research group, that, you know, once that 2019 election took place and the red wall fell from Labour to the Conservatives, that the Conservative Party would finally understand the realignment of British politics, understand the voters that were willing to vote for the centre-right were no longer the type of voters that had been pandered to under the Blair-Cameron consensus. And sadly, when I was soon in Parliament, realised that that battle just couldn't be won internally, particularly from 2023 onwards. It was quite a depressing time to be in there, but at the same time knew that election was coming and it was my job just to do the best I could for my constituency, regardless of knowing the fact that the outcome was going to be my backside was going to be shown the door.
Stoke-on-Trent North, as you say, has got a great industrial history. It's one of the biggest manufacturing areas of the UK, actually, if you look back in history, particularly in the 18th century. Many people, though, living there have always voted Labour. It's a Labour stronghold, or at least it was. And there have been moments, of course, when we've seen a glimmer of change. And, of course, when you got elected, that was one of those moments. But how do you think the people of Stoke-on-Trent North will really embrace the potential of a reform, either candidate or eventually a government, when we're already seeing in the by-election with Denton and Gorton how there are many confused voters? They perhaps think, yeah, reform is great because it's going to indicate change, but for many of them it's actually going to potentially cause them some pain in the short term as well.
So I think you're right in saying that voters really now understand that if they want genuine change and really bold ideas, then the only option on the table for them is Reform UK. They feel deeply let down. There was no shock that when I was elected in 2019, they'd had a Labour council for decades. They'd had 70 years of Labour MPs. During the whole Blair-Brown era, things like the Climate Change Act under Ed Miliband had come into play before, obviously, Theresa May doubled down on it and essentially felt completely and utterly ignored. I remember speaking to a socialist who told me that one of the reasons that Brexit was so heavily voted for was because if they felt London wasn't listening to them, they certainly didn't think Brussels would even know where they were on a map. So I think that it was just a natural shift of voters, predominantly on social issues. You know, Stoke-on-Trent has been treated as a dumping ground for illegal migration. We've got over 1,300 asylum seekers and illegal migrants in our city. The ratio in a ward is not meant to be more than one asylum seeker for 200 sort of local residents. In Hanley and Etruria, it's actually one in 30. That is deeply damaging. And when you see hotels like I saw opposite our railway station become a opportunity for a particular hotel chain to profiteer off the state and the British taxpayer, and at the same time create an eyesore and devalue the city, which has 6 million visitors pass through that railway station annually, that's just doing down the city further. But it's because it's got cheap housing that meant that it was an opportunity for Serco and others to fully take advantage. And I think, therefore, that epitomises why people are looking for something different. But absolutely, there is going to also be a huge dose of scepticism, because the 2019 Conservative government promised change and levelling up. That didn't happen anywhere near as quickly or as rapidly as people wanted it to. Labour literally ran on the slogan of change and have literally been breaking every promise they made in the manifesto and committed now 13 U-turns in order to try and just save Sir Keir Starmer's premiership. So people are rightly going to say, we're willing to roll the dice on you guys because at the end of the day, we've got no other choice but to. But what are you actually going to do? And that's where I think Danny Kruger has been really important in the stuff he's been saying, which is we're going to have to put more than just a manifesto forward. We have to put a detailed plan, even if that includes draft legislation, so people are fully aware of what they're voting for and absolutely be honest with the British public about the trade-offs of what that might mean. But also then it makes clear to the establishment, the civil service, the quangos, the judiciary, we have a mandate for this. Don't get in our way. Otherwise, you will force us to look at the system even further. Because at the end of the day, it's Parliament that is sovereign. It's Parliament that's the rule maker. It's the Parliament that's the final judge, essentially, when it comes to our laws and our and what the government wants to deliver. And so I think that's very important to see through. Things like, for example, the triple lock, we're going to have that frank and honest conversation. It is going to be a huge cost to the British taxpayer. At the same time, lots of young people can't even get on the property ladder, and we have youth unemployment at 15.9%. These are scary figures because that's our children and grandchildren not being able to start getting into a well-paid job so they can have the same opportunities that many of us have been afforded. So, you know, I think there is an honest conversation about we're ditching the triple lock and coming up with maybe the double lock or just rating it in line with a salary increase percentage annually in order to free up cash that can be put into reducing taxes on individuals and on businesses. Those are the type of trade-offs that we're going to have to be upfront about. But I think if we are upfront about it, despite the Westminster media will try and say that we're betraying voters and despite political parties of other colours trying to say that we're undermining things, the truth of the matter is we're the only ones being honest about the solutions to the problem. They know it. They know this is a conversation they need to have, but they'll dodge it because they're not brave enough to take those decisions. And I think Nigel Farage has shown for decades conviction of his beliefs and bravery to say things that at a time may be unpopular, but now hilariously are the mainstream British politics.
One of the criticisms that reform is facing at the moment is a lack of coherent policy. We've seen some elements of policy being released, and Zia Yusuf, as the head of policy, has obviously started to look very deeply at some of those areas and in preparation for government, whenever that might be. You've touched on the triple lock, pensions. What other areas of policy do you see there being some big trade-offs? For example, going back to the red wall in for example, Stoke-on-Trent, what are the trade-offs that people are going to have to face that are going to have to be written up in policy terms?
So look, first of all, with what Zia is doing, I think is incredible because at the end of the day, we're what, a party that's really around 3 years old and we're being asked to scale up at a pace never seen before in the history of British politics. And so when I see the attacks from the Conservatives and Labour, I find it hilarious because I don't really know what Conservative policy is either at the moment. What I do know is they promised tens of thousands of immigration and it got to nearly a million in 2023. I know they promised lower taxes and the tax burden got to a record high. I know they promised to back our industrial base, but it ended up deindustrialising our country and allowing jobs to go overseas to China and India and elsewhere. So they're number one. Labour... even more hilarious, literally looking farmers in the face and promising we'll never introduce inheritance tax and then literally doing the exact opposite of what they promised at the NFU's own conference, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that's where it was done, as well as obviously with pensioners. The first thing they did is remove the winter fuel payments, which I thought was cold and callous at the end of the day. So other parties wanting to criticise and throw stones. You know, the Liberal Democrats promised university students in 2010 not to raise tuition fees. Lo and behold, Nick Clegg gets offered Deputy Prime Minister and instantly is willing to sell out on one of his biggest pledges of that election. So the idea that other parties have credibility is for the birds, just no matter how much the media, or mainstream media, may I say, tries to push it. But as for trade-offs, for education, for example, we're going to have to invest more money. If we want to really reskill our country and not rely on mass migration, for example, there is going to be a trade-off. There will be a short-term hit to the economy. Businesses will say there are shortages and they will panic and they will make noise and they will demand that we pull that lever of mass migration for the short term whilst we do the scaling up. But we have to resist those calls. And I think there will be potentially some economic uncertainty at that time. But if we do the right thing and put the money instead into scaling up our future generations, or reskilling people who are maybe looking for new job opportunities currently sat on welfare. That, for me, is common sense and will long-term lead to economic growth. You know, Zia's done a lot of work visiting the Centre for Social Justice, a think tank that I'm involved with as a senior fellow. You know, we've done a lot of work looking at how you trade off of welfare. People with mild anxiety, depression, for example, shouldn't be getting money. Instead, they should be getting talking therapy. And if you said you're going to remove money from those people, you'll get the media outcry. But imagine what we could do. We could save, we estimate, 8 to 9 billion, the Centre for Social Justice has suggested. Put $1 billion of that into doubling the amount of talking therapies available, and then having a net load of money that you could look at reducing tax burden on business to incentivize them to hire people and train people instead. It's no shock, is it, that we see youth unemployment rising when you equalize the national living wage for an 18-year-old with a 25-year-old, when that 18-year-old will not have the same experience nor qualifications as that 25-year-old. It's not a shock that when you hike national insurance on employers, they're going to say as well, well, how do you expect me to carry on looking after staff? So I think that those are the type of frank and difficult things that we have to do. The problem is, the longer this Labour government seems to be in power, the more debt and more borrowing they seem to be heaving onto the country, which means many of the things we want to do in Reform UK are probably going to have to be paused. And that's why we're going to have to be honest with our voter base and say, we want to cut taxes rapidly. We want to deregulate as quickly as we can. But at the same time, we've got to deal with the reality of the circumstances that we inherit. And the problem is that Labour's leaving an awful mess behind. And so it's going to be maybe slower and therefore more frustrating. But if we're consistent and we're willing to take difficult trade-offs, as I say, with like the triple lock on pensions, then I think we can ultimately keep the trust of the British people to see, say, we're on a journey, not too dissimilar to what Margaret Thatcher was doing early on and those rocky waters that she went through. But there are sunnier uplands ahead.
There has been mention of a Great Repeal Act. In other words, a whole list of acts of Parliament that Reform would repeal when they get into office in order to cut regulation, effectively cutting taxation for the engine of the economy, which in many regards is small businesses, not just big businesses, yes, but small businesses. Now, by growing GDP, of course, many of the problems that you're talking about would to a certain extent be mitigated, because with a growth in the economy, that not only gives us more income, but it actually solves a lot of problems in terms of unemployment, inflation. There are lots of other positive benefits from growing GDP, which clearly the Labour government don't understand. What they're doing at the moment, of course, is reducing GDP. And I'm surprised we aren't in an official recession. I think probably we've been in recession really for the last 2 years, but the ONS very very neatly enables us not to actually ever meet that R word. How do you see businesses being supported by Reform in terms of their in terms of their policy and in terms of the legislative framework that they have to work within?
So first of all, you are right. We need a Great Repeal Act, and that should be one of the first acts of a Reform UK government. The problem is governments love coming in and creating new laws or adding on to existing laws because it gives a sense of they've done something. The reality is, in many cases, you're replicating what already exists in the system or creating more confusion, which is why we see the government regularly taken to court through judicial reviews because of confusion in what the law's trying to say, when sometimes there's an overlap in different acts of Parliament. Now, I make no bones about it, a Reform UK government should be coming in and we should be sitting 7 days a week, 18 hours a day if needs be, and I'm being generous there just to make sure we get a bit of close eye, shut eye. But, you know, to be that aggressive out the gates, to set the tone of this is what it's going to be like in a Reform UK government. We have too many politicians in Westminster, and I was guilty of it as well, falling into the trap of being basically glorified local councillors and talking about hedgerows and potholes, all important stuff, all stuff that needs to be dealt with. But the duty of a Member of Parliament is to talk about the national issues and what the national government can do in the nation's interest, not just in their local area. So you are correct. When I say about a Great Repeal Act, I'm not just talking about the Human Rights Act. I'm not talking about the Equality Act. You know, I would like our constitution to go back to the pre-1997 Blair year, you know, pre-1997 Tony Blair time, which I think worked sufficiently well, particularly when it came to not having an overbloated state. I'd like us to take apart the quangos that, quite frankly, should be under the control of ministers and the responsibility of ministers, so there's no confusion. To give you a quick example, in Kidsgrove Sports Centre, we wanted to refurbish the existing building and reopen it. Sports England said that because we wanted to do that, they'd only give us £150,000 towards an £8 million, £9 million renovation. But if we wanted to build a brand new one on a brand new site, they'd give us £12 million. And when I said, but I'm going to renovate an existing one right next to a large secondary school and save you £4 or £5 million. And they went, no, that isn't how it works. And when I asked the minister, he said, well, what can I do? I can't tell them what to do. And I was just like, but that's taxpayers' money that funds Sport England. You're the minister that oversees Sport England. What do you mean you can't tell them what to do? This is crazy. So in terms of business, though, so IR35 has obviously been absolutely disastrous for many small, medium-sized businesses. That isn't a huge financial burden. You know, we can find the money to scrap those rules that have been brought in straight away. You've obviously got to look at business rates, and that needs big reform, and there's going to be some big discussions about how you do that. We see what Labour's doing right now to pubs, restaurants, hotels, shops on the high street by scrapping the previous government's reduction in business rates, which was at least allowing them to survive, still not thrive, but at least survive. Our high streets are sadly going to probably look bleaker in the years to come. And then looking at workers, and I think that does mean having that frank discussion about the living wage and understanding that every time that raises the issue, costs onto business, and that form means the prices have to raise on shelves. You know, we need to have those frank and honest conversations. And then VAT, you know, for certain sectors of the economy, should we actually be looking to drop VAT even further, as well as corporation tax, which should never have gone back up to 25%, and, you know, should go back down. We should be competing with the rest of the world. We should be competing with Ireland. We should be trying to get ours lower so we could go to Ireland, we can go to Frankfurt and say, if you want to bring your financial services, or if you want to bring your big business like Google to the UK, this is a better place to be in. But it is about red tape. So it's about the quangos, and then it's about taxation and trying to find what can be done quickly, particularly, I reckon, around corporation tax, VAT, all of which, yes, comes at a cost essentially to the British government, but that cost is via the British taxpayer. If the British taxpayer has more money in their pocket, they can go out and enjoy themselves more, they can invest more. Businesses will then have more money to invest in their workforce or invest in new technologies that are emerging, so they can be more profitable too. The problem is we're squeezing the life out of everyone. So I can't profess to be from a business background, but I'm keen to hear from business about what can be done, particularly in your manufacturing base, the net zero madness, by scrapping the Climate Change Act, for example. That would be a really positive thing. These net zero targets that are driving up the cost of gas and electricity, getting them off as well would have a huge positive impact too.
I completely accept what you say. I think that's very, very wise. One of my concerns is the growth of the state. And of course, Reform have really promised to push back the boundaries of the state. That's one of their big core values, very much in line with, of course, Thatcherite values and traditional conservative views as well, which is where there are a lot of overlaps, I think, between Reform and true conservatives. When we see that GDP is now made up by 45% of the public sector, this is a very worrying position we find ourselves in. And when I hear you talk about Kidsgrove Centre and what happened there with Sport England, I wonder why a third option wasn't on the table, which is to sell it and put it into the hands of a private company. And the belief that competition within private markets can actually drive down prices for consumers, can ensure that inflation is kept a grip of because there's competition, and it can reduce the size of the state. What do you think about that?
So with Kidsgrove Sports Centre, it's a community-run asset, so there is essentially a charitable group now running it. It has got some subsidies in the short term coming from Newcastle Underlying Borough Council to make sure it remains on an even keel whilst it's growing its membership. But I think it's important that at times the state does step in for certain elements of those. You know, we had one of the highest obesity rates in children in the country, and yet had no access to a local swimming pool or no access to a local gym facilities in a town that covers 25,000 people. Now, actually, they've done a fantastic job, the community group, of raising, you know, I think about 1,200 members. That means that it can be sufficiently stable on its own feet. And I think that, yes, then when those subsidies go, it is then responsibility of that group, or indeed a private firm who may want to work with a community group to take over the running of such a facility. So I totally accept that challenge. You know, in Stoke-on-Trent, I did an FOI where I think that the city council spends £5 million a year from the last data they had available on just running local leisure centres. Now, you think about how many, as you say, private ones there are. Well, imagine, for example, if we got rid of that and we said that 5 million ended up being what would be a 5% council tax cut to local people. That would be, I think, hugely positive. Now, the trade-off is, of course, the council won't run its own facilities. You'll have to rely on private sector facilities. But when you look at the cost of memberships, actually, ironically, the private sector ones are cheaper than the council-run ones. Then you look at the sites. So, for example, Fenton Manor Sports Complex, as an example, is a huge site. Now, there's a lot of fear in Stoke-on-Trent about building on Green Belt. We all want to care for our green spaces. But at Fenton Manor Sports Complex, you could probably fill in a load of housing in that area and exist in an area that's already built up, therefore meeting the housing targets that we need, whilst also protecting important Green Belt land in places like Packmore, for example, too, which I think would be a hugely positive thing and would generate some capital investment for the City Council then to invest in, you know, improving high streets or working
or
with
reducing local, council tax.
Or reducing council tax even further. But I do think there is going to be a trade-off at times. I think modern conservatism has to be that, you know, we have to decide what we can deem as critical. So I sometimes see the Conservative Party attack us for our position on steelmaking and the fact that we would have been and we would nationalise British Steel. But I keep going, why would you not want to keep virgin steelmaking in this country that then is just to be used for critical national infrastructure projects, therefore creating and maintaining jobs in our country, providing UK British Steel for British the British state or important projects, and not making us reliant on China, who we accept are a major national security threat and would absolutely manipulate the markets against us if there was ever any confrontation, or even if they invaded Taiwan in order to hold us hostage, knowing that obviously we've got nowhere else to look or go. So I think that's a trade-off that we have to accept in modern times. But in terms of rolling back the state further, look, I would like to see a reform UK government have a much smaller amount of government departments. The Department for Culture, Media and Sport doesn't need to exist. I don't know why we have a Department for Science, Information and Technology and a Department for Business and Trade and the Treasury. That's three big government departments that actually are essentially all doing and replicating the same thing. There's an argument to be made about environment, food and rural affairs. You know, again, how could we roll that into existing departments? So I would like to see a much smaller cabinet table with much reduced government departments in order to actually therefore make a saving to the British taxpayer. So when we've heard the rumours about Richard Tice potentially being made the shadow spokesperson for business and energy, well, that makes sense to me. Business, trade, energy, and science and technology for me should all just come under one brief and one portfolio because they all rely on each other in order to succeed. So I think that's really important work, and the work Danny Kruger's doing in terms of preparing us for government, that's going to be vitally important when it comes to making sure that that plan is outlined so we can show people we are serious about reducing the size of, as you say, this bloated state, and the quangos in particular have to be our primary target early on.
You've been an MP, Jonathan, so you've seen into the heart of Westminster and you've worked with civil servants. People often criticise, ex-MPs, current MPs, criticise the civil service for their role in expanding the size of the state. And indeed, the blob was, you know, has been many times criticised for its role in this underlying thread, which is growing its own sort of voter base in a way. Obviously, I know they're not elected; they're unelected officials. But the reasons why we need to have more civil servants and so on. What do you think are going to be the challenges for a reform government in terms of dealing with the civil service?
So, first of all, there's a great piece by Tim Shipman in The Spectator where he's clearly spoken with Zia and Danny Kruger, and Danny has said there are talented people in the civil service. Many of them are more in the junior ranks. And the problem is because they're talented, they come up against the bureaucracy and the blob itself because there is a bit like, as I said earlier, with the manufacturing, there's a generations of families that have gone into the civil service one after the other, and they see it as their duty to protect it rather than understand it's their duty to actually work for the elected government of the time. You know, when I was a minister in the Department for Education, I had a private office of six people. These were young, hungry types who were very keen and malleable to wanting to do great things. The problem it was that you've kind of got these different layers of management that I think is more horizontal than vertical. And so the problem with that is there's no real like thread or chain of command when it comes to delivering policy. There might be on paper, but it doesn't feel like it operates in that way. And so the problem is everyone's just passing, shuffling things between one another. So to give you another example, there was money that goes towards helping primary schools deliver PE lessons. Part of that money came from the Department of Education, part of it came from the Department of Culture, Media and Sport, and part of it came from the Department of Health and Social Care. And I remember saying, well, can we just convene a meeting with my respective counterparts in those respective departments and we'll just hash out what it is we need to do? And I almost got looked at like this was some sort of foreign idea to get someone in a room together and just hash out what money have you got, what have you got, like let's put a 3-year plan together. And ultimately the civil service were more interested in me writing letters and sort of passing it around like that rather than just getting in a room and hashing it out. So I always wondered why. There was another example when there was some polling that was wanted to be done to understand how schools were reducing workload. And I said, well, why do we need to spend $600,000 on polling with the Department of Education? Why don't we just write to schools, have a portal on our website and say to them, submit your ideas. And we'll just design some badge that the best 10 or best 20 can say that they are, DfE award for, outstanding teacher recruitment and retention. And the civil servant kept pushing as if I had to sign off on this. Now, I never did, but they kept wanting me to sign it off. And at one point you start to go, why are you so het about something that's 600,000, which in the grand schemes of that department is small change when it comes to government spend. So you do worry, like, what's going on behind the scenes that you're not seeing. So my view is, as Danny has said, we go into the civil service and say, look, we have a mandate and it's very clearly been won and we want to work with you. And if you want to work with us and deliver, there's going to be huge opportunities for you to progress in your careers and for you to introduce and share exciting ideas based along the government's agenda. But if you don't want to get on board, there's obviously going to be consequences. And I think trying to play nice at the beginning is important. And then very quickly, have to stop, but make sure you're building up your armory to deal with inevitably what will be a fight from within, which I'm sad to say will happen. And based on the fact that it's ideological madness of civil servants who forget that their job is to serve the elected government of this country. So that will be a huge challenge. I think it does come back to performance-related pay. I do think that we should look at bonus schemes rather than giving huge salary rises that actually reward people doing the right thing. I think we should be making it easier for people to be removed from the civil service as well if they're not performing. I think even Darren Jones, the Labour Minister, said there was only something like maybe less than 100 people in the entire civil service on any form of performance management. Now, in a civil service of that size, I think all of us can roll our eyes and think, how can any business or institution of that size, of that many workers, only have less than 100 people who are, not meeting the expected standard? I query that, and I think many others would do too. So, this is where we need to really ramp up and be brave. And tell the civil servants now, if you don't want to be involved in the project, then okay, if you've got to go, you've got to go. But there'll be lots of other people waiting to take your place. And actually, what can we do to recruit talent from outside of London? And so actually the Places for Growth idea under the last Conservative government, I think was a good idea. The idea of trying to have government departments in part work outside of London so it could recruit local people to inject fresh ideas from outside the university liberal chattering classes that is central London that sadly most of the civil service is awash with. So it's going to be a big challenge and we're going to have to be quite bold and straight up and be willing to find ways. If you look at what Nadeem Zahawi did when we were when I was with him in Parliament and he did the vaccines rollout, why did that work? Because they got rid of normal procurement regulations, they got rid of judicial reviews, and that should enable the civil service to work with the private sector in a much more meaningful and rapid way and therefore deliver those vaccinations at that time around the country much more quickly. That, I think, is actually a really interesting piece of work that Dominic Cummings certainly has looked at and was part of as a way of what can be done to replicate in, that across the state so you can actually deliver very quickly these type of changes that are needed.
Yes, and I mean, aside from the pros and cons to the whole vaccine rollout and the questions that have been raised about that since, of course, the efficacy of those vaccines and so on, this ability to work with the private sector, I think, is absolutely key. And I think what you mentioned also about British Steel, one of the phrases that comes to my mind is the moral hazard. We have to be aware that when, clearly the British Steel decision had to be made rapidly, and thankfully the government listened to reform on this occasion, and I think we led the way on that one.
We were the
standard bearers on that one, and secured that again, as you say, for the British economy, very important. Nevertheless, I wonder what the philosophical and ideological thinking is if we are going to take that approach with lots of other business type enterprises. There is a moral hazard that's going to face us on those kind of questions. Where do you think reform will go, or if there was another big industry, for example, that was about to fail? Is it necessary for us always to be bailing them out?
No, it's not necessary for us to always bail out. I think those industries or sectors that are critically important to the infrastructure of our country, or the defence of our country, for example, they should be looked at. But the reality is that you can't prop up the private sector. At the end of the day, you know, we do also believe in a free trading market and world as well. And so I think that's just the reality of having to accept that, sadly, the global order is not what it once was in the 1980s. You know, China, India manipulate the markets, right? They've got a labour force that's either very cheap or, sadly, in some cases, particularly in China, slave labour, which means that those overheads, they obviously subsidise aggressively and heavily their energy prices, and then they're knocking up coal power stations at a rate of knots. Yet the UK is the one that's beating itself up for only being wanting to get to net zero, despite only being responsible for less than 1% of the world's global emissions. It's just madness personified at the end of the day. So I think that it's just, again, being honest. But I think what we then need to do is go into those communities where those impacts are felt and say, we're going to help steer direction and conversation about what's the future industry in this area. So somewhere like Stoke-on-Trent, it's a creative city. Ceramics is important, and the ceramic manufacturers that are surviving are because they are very cleverly going for high-end products and trading those across the world to hotels, casinos and restaurants. And that is a product that will always be wanted, because at the end of the day, your IKEA plate from China will only last so long before it can easily get infected with bacteria and therefore have implications for a hospitality sector. So I have confidence that kind of market can exist. And there's advanced ceramics, very exciting stuff, particularly when it comes to the fact that we have ceramics on our laptops, our phones, our knee replacements. You know, that all involves ceramics, and our defence as well. So I think there is a place of how can we allow those. And that's when we come to deregulation and bringing down costs of energy, as well as obviously helping them recruit and scale up a pipeline of talented people to go into them. So, you know, there's ways of doing that without the state having to be directly involved or bail out. It's about actually the state finding ways to support, which doesn't mean having to always hold the hand, just means getting out the way of certain things, which I think is important. So, you know, but on the other hand, we have full fibre network in the city. We were one of the first cities to get the digital T-levels introduced. And we have Staffordshire University, which is the leading video games university in the country in terms of graduates and esports. I know, I've made it uncool now I've said it. But, you know, in the NIA, I think they get 100,000 people turn up over the course of a weekend to go and watch other people play video games. In South Korea, I think there's something like 30,000, 40,000 seater stadiums sold out to watch it. More people watch esports than they watch actual live sports in places like South Korea or Japan. I can't remember which one it was. That, again, blows my mind. But if you've got, therefore, the full fibre network, if you've got the pipeline of talent, either through a T-level or through the university, then why should Stoke-on-Trent not be the home of the video games industry? And, you know, we wanted to build an arena in the city of Stoke-on-Trent, which would have required some government investment alongside private sector investment, but then have it built with an esports arena ready to go. We should have been the only one in the country outside of the Copper Box in London. And having spoken to esports teams, they were willing to bring their teams to base in Stoke-on-Trent because of the cost to it. So I was really excited by that idea that could have been done. But again, because we have a state that's so in control back in Westminster, rather than devolving powers to local areas to make us competitive in the space around whether that be corporation tax, business rates, or indeed national insurance, maybe for employers, finding ways for local areas to say, let's reduce those costs for our local areas so that for us, if you bring your business to our area. And then that way, then every area can compete, but also find its own niche. And that would have been a real positive thing that I wanted to see happen. And that's where the state can, without having to, bail out an industry, but in fact help create the future of a new one in a local area.
I'm delighted that we're now joined by Ken Ferguson, my co-host on the podcast. So he is here to grill, finally.
Trembling.
to grill Jonathan. But I just want to ask Jonathan a final question. You alluded to the fact that we're going to have some tough messages if we get into government. What kind of personalities, what kind of traits do you think we should be looking for in our candidates?
So people, ideally, who actually don't come from a traditional political background, therefore not easily swayed, and actually older, I would suggest, as well. I think we got too obsessed in Westminster with people having to sort of look young, bright things, particularly after Blair and Cameron. The idea is everyone's got to be in their sort of mid to late 30s in order to be a leader, because it's all about looks and image. And actually, the truth of the matter is we need experience. And I think you've seen a part of that with Donald Trump in the United States of America. Whilst I'm sure we don't agree with everything all the time, he certainly brought a business background and a business mentality to politics, as well as what we've seen in other countries too. You know, Nicolas Bukele, for example, yes, younger, but has brought a freshness. Milei, you know, an economist to Argentina, not bogged down by traditional party politics and not bogged down by sort of very strict party ideology, but instead looking at things from a wider perspective and learning and teaching from around the world. So I want to see a Reform UK parliamentary party stuffed with people who have worked in different sectors of our economy, both in the public and the private sector, who have come from the shop floor up to the top ranks, who understand what life is really like and had that real world lived experience, rather than what we've seen with many of these Labour MPs who have worked for think tanks or have worked for members of parliament and are now just obviously following the sort of the traditional footstep. Because the problem is, it is a bubble. And it's easy to get trapped in that and the way it works and the mindset that that bubble tries to impose upon itself. And, you know, I like to think myself, you know, I spent 8 years in state school education as a teacher, as a middle leader, as a head of year, dealing with behaviour, dealing with attendance, dealing with academic outcomes. I was also a trade union representative for the NASUWT, which was originally done as a joke by my colleagues, but ended up being a great asset. And obviously the NASUWT hates it every time I get to mention it. So I'm looking forward to triggering them again, because actually that in itself gave me an insight, right, of how the union mentality, and it's scary to see how the union is basically just another political machine rather than doing what I actually expected it to be, which is there to represent workers, but also tell workers sometimes that there are trade-offs too, and that they can have a win here, but they're going to have to accept a loss in return over there. And I always find that utterly bizarre. So it's going to be someone who's got real moral strength. This is, our candidates are going to be looked into and investigated at a rate that we've never seen before. We know Labour together, we're literally hiring private investigators to look into candidates for the Conservative Party at the last general election. The media are going to throw every kind of slur and whiff of scandal. Leila Cunningham was on the front page of the Mirror recently simply because she'd had a photo with someone who was alleged to have been involved in taking drugs, but her crime was having a photo with this individual, and that now apparently constitutes as front page news. This is the crazy world that we live in. So they're going to have to, my advice would be to anyone who's thinking about it, your family really have to be on board, because the abuse that's going to come, the pressure that's going to come, you might be able to stomach it, but the question is, will your wife or your husband and your children and your mum and your dad? Because I saw how it affected my family. And my wife would love me to walk away from frontline politics, but also knows I've still got a passion for it and so will support me. But she dreads it every day. She dreads it. And the abuse that she's had into her own private social media platform, which is not public at all, for just being married to me, despite having completely the opposite politics of mine, goes to show just how narrow-minded many people are, sadly.
Right. The main areas I wanted to explore with you, you're just talking about your background in education. What subject did you teach?
So I was trained in citizenship, uh-huh. Which is basically sort of politics, but for 11 to 16-year-olds. And then I predominantly ended up teaching RE and history for most of my career as in humanities.
Right. And you had quite a long career with Michael Gove, didn't you, in the Department of Education?
Yeah, so I was a teacher under Gove's reforms. In fact, I came in as a minister under Liz Truss's organisation. So I had 51 glorious days as a minister, which I'll still trade around on. But yeah, didn't get the length of time I hoped for. But I was on the Education Select Committee,
yeah.
And I was also a co-chair of the APPG for apprenticeships.
Right, good. Well, I mean, that period when Gove was in the Education Department, it was probably one of the few positive outcomes that came in 14 years of government, wasn't
yes.
it? I mean, he really revolutionised the education system in that short time. Now, I feel that reform is weak on education. I had a look at our education policies, or at least the stuff that was in our contract with the people for the last election, and there's not a lot there, if I'm truthful. And I think education is one of the main areas in the country that needs massive reform. Do you agree with that?
I totally agree with you. So at the Centre for Social Justice, where I'm a senior fellow,
yeah.
I'm in charge of a scheme work called Rewiring Education. We actually launched our first report where Michael Gove was there,
yeah.
Ian Solomon for the Liberal Democrats.
Just interrupt for a second. Any chance Michael Gove would come over to us?
I don't think so, no. I think he's... and
yeah, I know he's very happily ensconced as editor of The Spectator, but I mean, every time I see him, I just admire the huge brain he's got.
He is one of the biggest brains, and he should never be underestimated, but I think that he is more of on the liberal-minded sort of One Nation view of the Conservative Party in some ways.
He was for Leave, wasn't he?
He was for Leave, and like I say, I'm good friends with Michael and always say good things about him. I just don't... I can't envisage him being in Reform UK,
yeah.
But I think that Michael's also someone who will work with anyone and everyone, and so if there's an opportunity to sit down, if Zia wants to sit down and ever meet with Michael Gove and learn from him, take that opportunity. A bit like Dominic Cummings, I would want to harvest what these guys have and know and understand. So I wouldn't want to waste the opportunity. And in fact, if Reform, and I certainly hope when Reform come into government, don't be afraid to say to Michael,
yeah.
You're a lord of the realm of the Conservatives. You can certainly change that badge to Reform UK and potentially help
I'm sure he's got some fantastic ideas he could help us with. Let me run a couple of mine by you in
yes.
terms of where I think our reform should be going. First of all, on in the secondary education, I think we need to drastically cut the number of university places.
Yes.
Now, I mean, you were talking on CSG the other day about technical education. So one of the ways to get more people into technical education is to limit the number of places in higher education, isn't it?
Look, absolutely. We've got way too many universities. And the problem is, actually, we did huge damage to technical education when we turned polytechnics into universities. Polytechnics are a good thing. Now, you can rebadge them as institutes of technology or institutes of health, whatever it is that you want to do. And as I say, for Staffordshire University, I think it should be an institute of technology because of its video games, esports speciality, and really stand out. And I went to Oxford Brookes, an old polytechnic. Again, I think it should go down a different road rather than trying to compete with Oxford. So number one, absolutely, we don't need 120 universities across the country. And a reform government should say, if your whole model is based on having foreign students simply to prop up your cash pool, and which is many of those lower grade universities in terms of quality that they provide, once you go bankrupt, that's tough. That's just the way it is. The fact that we've got loads of students who, if you're outside the top 20 universities, are graduates, 700,000 graduates currently on welfare, because they would have gone to most of the universities outside the top 20 that don't provide the quality within the degree to help them get the job they desire in the workforce. Why is it that engineering is a degree rather than apprenticeship degree? Sorry, there we go. I've probably got the words out. Technical degree where you're working for an employer, you're gaining the qualification. Yes, you can still have it certified by university, but it's actually lived real world experience to understand the challenges day in, day out. You could do the same with architects. For example, film studies or whatever it is that goes on there. Warner Brothers Studios got this massive base in Buckinghamshire. Why not ask them to take on a load of apprenticeships and offer opportunities for those people to work in the real world rather than saddle up loads of debt, which students pay off for potentially for 30 years, but then actually two-thirds are being paid off by the taxpayer, many of whom would not have gone to university. So yes, that's a trade-off that should be made and be bravely made, because we don't need 120 universities in a country of our size.
Well, let's move on to secondary education, which, of course, was what you were working on with Gove. Let me tell you what I would do, or my proposal, and you can tell me why it wouldn't work. What I think we should be doing is, first of all, taking all schools out of local education authority control.
Yes.
Secondly, I think they should all become academies, and self-governing academies.
Yes.
like the fantastic Michaela School and so on. So you have completely break the tie with local government. In terms of funding, what I would do is give a voucher to every adult, every parent of every child, which they are free to go and take the voucher and spend anywhere they like, in any school they want. You then create effectively a market then in education. So the good schools will prosper because they'll get lots of people coming to them with a voucher saying, I want to send my child here. The poor schools will wither away. And you complete, in my view, you would completely revolutionise. Also, it gives parents choice, which has got to be good. Tell me why that doesn't work.
So I totally agree with you on academisation, and that's one of my things I was very angry about with the last Conservative government, was they didn't fully academise the system. I don't understand why. Mm. And actually, you could have done it in a way that if you took the old Ofsted framework, not the one that this Labour Party is bringing in, which is just jargonitis, if you took the original Ofsted framework, you could actually just take probably at least a third, I reckon, of it, and instead inspect multi-academy trust boards at the director level, which means you reduce the burden of inspection on the individual school. Because we're in this mad situation where if a multi-academy trust fails an inspection, the schools within it cannot leave unless the multi-academy trust gives them permission to do so or goes bust. That's not choice. That's you're trapping schools with poor leaders. So
let's just take a step back from that, though, because what you're talking about there is inspections.
Yes, sorry.
Now, in my view, if you were to run some kind of, get some market forces involved in the education system, you could almost scrap the inspections because
it would be irrelevant
because people would vote with their feet. If it's a good school, they would send their child there and they would prosper. So there's no need to inspect them. You know if the school's doubling its intake in a year, it's doing something right.
So I understand the theory. I would always want there to be a level of inspection, particularly because of the safeguarding elements within some of the young people, and having dealt with some very serious children who are either in care or have fallen into, in one case, a grooming gang. You know, I think that would be, I'd be nervous about that. I totally understand the logic. And I think to your point about the voucher scheme, I've heard it from other people and I sort of understand the idea. My concern is if some schools is shut down, are you limiting choice by geography? Because for some parents in places like Stoke who don't even own vehicles to be able to commute to their kids to school and therefore have a very as well poor bus service, would those children not be able to easily access education, and would that potentially add further cost on to a household? Whereas, and I think that if we had a full academised system and we allowed the best academies to thrive and survive, then that competition would naturally be created within a different style of market force. So,
could I throw something in there about early years and childcare? Because this model is exactly what I propose to reform.
Well, that's what they've got in early years and childcare. Why not extend it through the system?
Correct. Because this is one of the problems with early years and childcare, is that you have a mixture of state providers, you know, school providing some early years provision, and nursery provision, which is obviously the private sector. It's an absolute mishmash. It's terrible for parents to navigate. They've got a certain amount of free hours. If you get additional benefits, you get certain extra free hours. A voucher scheme would solve all of those problems, and it would enable parents to be able to make the choice based on the voucher that they've received. And again, it would enable the best providers to thrive and to increase their numbers, increase their places. And this would then pave the way for children going to school. You'd almost embed it into a kind of cultural perspective on education to say, this is how we run education from zero to 16 is where I'd like to see it, not 18, 16. At 16 there needs to be a complete change as well.
The argument I've heard against vouchers is that the likelihood is that they would embed inequality. As you say, that children from poor areas would be stuck in a poor school and wouldn't be able to move. Now, there are ways of addressing that, because you could have differential vouchers. So you don't have to, that doesn't mean that the each voucher has to be worth £2,000 a term or whatever it is that the parent can spend. If the parent is from a poor background with or kids with extra needs or whatever, then you have a higher voucher, so you've got £3,000 or £5,000, whatever it is.
So the point is they have the choice to use that voucher
absolutely.
In the setting of their
and
decision,
the schools,
their choice.
There'll be an impetus on the schools to attract pupils. Because if they don't attract pupils, eventually they'll run out of money. So in order to do the things they want, to get the money to do the things, they have to take a certain proportion of people who've got higher amounts on their voucher. So there's all sorts of tinkering you can do around
yes.
it to not have a situation whereby you stop social mobility.
So it's an It's an idea I'm going to have to look into, an idea that I think I'll need to be won over on. I personally wouldn't feel comfortable with seeing that in primary or secondary education. I can understand the logic of it, but I'm always of the belief that ideas are there to be challenged, and people like me should be challenged on why my views may be wrong. And so I would always welcome evidence and ideas
away. We'll just open up a chance for another podcast, Jonathan.
There we go. I think it's great. Look, this is what we should be doing. We should be having debate and discussion ideas and on policy and trying to find a way forward. And I think that, you know, for too long now, people are scared to do that because they're worried about some headline or worried about how it might impact their political future. No, we should be, the whole point of politics is to debate ideas. I fell in love with politics because I watched the debates and arguments taking place, or reading about them, you know, in the 60s, 70s and 80s, where ideologically people were very opposed to one another. But actually hammering out those differences, I think, led to better policy in some cases being created. Now, my mum's a lifelong conservative. My dad is a Lib Dem / Tory. My stepfather is a Labour man, and my stepmother, well, her grandfather or great grandfather was an Irish nationalist MP. She's from the Republic of Ireland. She votes Green in this country. You know, so I always joke with people, I find it difficult to find agreement around my own dinner table, let alone out there in the public. But it's because of that passion and those difference of views that I always think, well, that's surely what politics is about. The guy who inspired me into politics was called Dr. Simon Peeple. He was a Labour council group leader at Tamworth Borough Council and a rabid socialist / Corbynista. But he was the one who inspired me into politics. And he could argue passionately for Thatcherism to create debate in his classrooms as much as he could passionately debate for socialism. I think that's a good thing that we shouldn't ever get away from.
Great. Jonathan Gullis, it's been great having you on the Reform Party podcast. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me. And thank you to everyone who tunes in. And make sure you share it amongst all your friends and make sure these guys get listened to more and more. A lot of home of common sense here that I'm sure will go far and far.
Yeah, great. Thanks.
Thanks.